And good afternoon, and welcome to Angel Answers with Amy Toy. I'm your host, and I have a very special guest with us today. Her name is Meadow Lynn. She is a noted speaker, writer, and chef, and is the daughter of Denise Lynn, world-renowned healer, teacher, and author of 16 selling books. When she was 18 years old, Meadow, a self-taught chef and lover of all things edible, started catering her mother's retreats, which she's been doing ever since. That has led her to an extraordinary collaboration with her mother on a brand new book called The Mystic Cookbook, The Secret Alchemy of Food, which we will be discussing today with Meadow. And it's filled with luscious recipes, imaginative meals, and magical wisdom. They open a portal for you to embark on the sacred journey from nourishment to nirvana and to harness the hidden dimension of food. And Meadow is also a writer of a blog called Savor the Day, which is about life, love, and good food. With her mother, she's co-authored Quest, a guide for creating your own vision quest, as well as the Mystic Cookbooks. Her articles appear frequently in the Seattle Chinese Times, and she's a contributing writer to the In Spirit magazine. And she has given, she's a wonderful lady. Welcome, Meadow. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's such a joy to be here.
Yes, and you have really, you are, I've had a guest prior to you that talked about being on one of your mother's retreats and talked about your cooking. So your name's getting around.
Oh, wow. Who is that?
Daniel. Well, I'll email you the name just in case. Actually, it was Daniel Sharp. He was on with the Soul Cooking.
Oh, he's such a love.
Yes. So when I got the request to be a guest, I said, I got to have her on. So why did you feel it was important to write the Mystic Cookbook? I mean, it's a really different book. Why did you feel it was so important to write it?
You know, it was a long journey in the process, I think, of coming to this culmination point. It's a blending of my passion in cooking and eating with my mom's passion in spirituality. And as you mentioned in the intro, Amy, for years, I think I started the summer after I graduated high school, and I am now 35, so it's been a long time that I've been cooking for her retreats. And through that process, we began to see the deep inner changes in personal growth that happened in the retreats, not just from the deep inner work that was happening in the classes, but also from mealtimes, because we made meals a celebration. And also because I had so much fun in the kitchen. You know, not every day is easy when you're cooking for 20 people and it's 100 degrees outside. But most of the time, you know, I have such a passion and love for cooking that it infuses into the food. And sometimes I even, you know, I'll sing and dance while I'm cooking. And it really makes a difference in the way that people taste and perceive the food. And then as far as the actual eating, we always take time to have a leisurely meal. We set the table to match the theme of the meal or the energy of the day. And my mom likes to call it the place settings kind of like mini altars. So if we're having an Indian meal, we might set the table with, my mom's got some statues of Buddhas and you know, Indian Buddhas and, Hindu. You know, she's got some Hindu statues as well. Or we have Mexican fiesta, and we'll have mariachi music playing and piñatas, and really set the scene and make food and dining a celebration and a time for community. And it really has made a big difference. And through that experience, we saw how powerful our connection to food is, not just what we eat, but how we eat. And we wanted to share that with others because food is something that everybody in the world does every day. We have to. And it's what connects us to other people. But also, the more that we can deepen and heighten our connection to food on a really joyous level, it can have rippling effects out into all aspects of our life. And as I said, because it's something we do every day, it's so vital that our relationship with food is one of health and vitality and joy and fun.
That is very true. That is, yes, and that's what this the Mystic Cookbook talks about, infusing that. And your mom, she's on, she's Denise Lynn. I love your mom too. I've heard her on Hay House. I've read her books. I even took her soul coaching oracle card, you know. And what was it like to work with your mom? I mean,
Oh, wow. Well, Amy, I don't think you've sent in your certification yet now, have you?
No, I haven't, because I did it for myself, okay?
I also make the certificates in my mom's office. So.
No, I just do it just because I just wanted, I loved, you know, it's great. Yeah, she's, and you have your mom's spirit too. There's a, you know, so, yeah, what was it like to work with your mom? It's awesome to have a
you
mom.
You know, it was a joy. We had so much fun working together. And, you know, to be honest, we weren't sure how it was going to work out at first because we have a really good relationship and we've worked together off and on for pretty much my whole life. You know, even as a little kid when she wrote her first book, you know, I was licking envelopes and always involved in the work that she was doing. But it's very different to be collaborating on a project together. And we were, you know, we were a little uncertain how that would work out because as mothers and daughters are off to do, you know, sometimes little strife comes up, you know. But the remarkable thing was we had so much fun working together and we grew even closer. We felt like it was almost the secret alchemy of food that we were writing about was even creating alchemy between us. And the more we wrote, the more similar we became. Sometimes we couldn't even distinguish who had written which sentence because we co-wrote the book and that we both wrote all of it. But sometimes we'd look back and say, I wrote that. Another one would say, no, I wrote that. Because our voice really became so similar. And as a result, I got a penchant for wearing flannel pajamas while I was working. Just like
oh, really?
My mom, so now we both work till midday in our pajamas, and it's really been a joy to work together, and it has given me a much deeper appreciation for the work that she has done for her entire career, and the how much she's helped people, and the effort that it takes to do what she's done. I've seen what she does from a completely different perspective.
Yes, it's interesting because, yes, she's a phenomenal lady. I like to listen to her Hay House Radio once in a while, and she does the soul, you know, the soul journeys or whatever, and it's interesting with things you can so.
And you know what's interesting with the food as far as soul journeys, I've even started doing that with meals, and it's something we write about in the Mystic Cookbook that you can do with your own meals, either for yourself or for a dinner party, is to... We call them like an inner journey to enhance your meal. But just like you were saying my mom does on the radio, you can actually close your eyes before a meal and picture yourself transported to another land, another time. For instance, when we have guests at our ranch for the retreats, if I'm serving, let's say, a French meal from the south of France. I lived in the south of France for a year studying literature. And so say I'm serving salad niçoise, I'll have everyone close their eyes and picture the azure coast and the pebbles on the beach and picture that they're in a cafe and they hear accordion music and they've got a really cute waiter wearing a striped T-shirt and they're holding a glass of cold Perrier in their hands. And then you dip in and you have your first bite of that salad niçoise. And it really becomes a multi-sensory experience where your whole experience of that meal is heightened, not just the flavor of the food and the textures and the aromas, but actually your spirit is almost like transported to this other place. And the food tastes that much better, but it also becomes almost a spiritual experience. And it's also a great way to travel the world without ever having to get a passport or pay for an airline ticket or go through security.
I love that. I hate that.
Yeah.
Not in my nation. So what is the secret alchemy of food? What is it? Is it what you're describing? Or is
wow, you want me to give that away?
Only if you want to.
No, well... The secret alchemy of food is really so many different things. And the first part of it, the idea of alchemy. You know, as we know, alchemists were part madmen, part scientists perhaps in olden days who tried to transform base metals into gold. And while with food we are not trying to turn our food into gold, the same principles apply. It's taking perhaps a common ingredient and blending it together to make something that's extraordinary, something that's more than the sum of its parts. And that's both on a physical and a spiritual level. The physical part is, you know, you can mix together, if we stick with the south of France, for instance, you mix together eggplant and bell peppers and zucchini, some basil, and some tomatoes. And each one of those ingredients on their own is good, but you mix them together and it becomes harmonious in this stew that is a ratatouille, which is much more than each of the individual ingredients. But then you take that a step further and add that spiritual component. As I said, I love to cook, so that passion, that joy infuses the food. And you can do it subconsciously just when you have a kind of innate passion, but you can also do it consciously. You can put affirmations. You can infuse love or joy or happiness into your food. As you stir the stew, you can stir in all the components that you want in that food, because it is actually more than its physical properties. That, you know, we look at things and we see it as solid and we say, oh yeah, that exists. But even Einstein said that the way that we understand matter is all wrong. It's actually all vibration and energy. So yeah. That is another part of that secret alchemy of food. It's that blending of each, that energy, that love we put into the food that really enhances it and enhances the way that our bodies metabolize it and experience it. And also our associations and beliefs about food affect it too. It is so much more than just, you know, an apple is not just an apple.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and I noticed you did put different quotes of Einstein and other spiritual teachers, if you will, throughout the book, which was pretty cool. And you have different exercises in the book, too. I thought that the book is very different than a regular cookbook. How is it different?
You know, in a lot of ways, we've called it it's a cookbook for your life in a lot of ways, that it does contain a number of original recipes, which mm-hmm. I painstakingly tested and photographed. And I'm perhaps a little biased, but I think they're all quite delicious. But it is a lot more than that. That the recipes are not the dominating part of the cookbook. It is more a book with recipes. And it is a book, you know, in a sense, it is a cookbook for your life, because our relationship with our food is so important to the way that we step out into the world, the way that we understand ourselves and our relationship with the rest of the world, that following the activities and the steps and the suggestions in the book can lead to increased joy, vitality, and understanding of ourselves and food. And so in that way, it's a cookbook for your life, that you're kind of cooking up magic that, on, you know, on one level it's with your food, but it actually extends to all aspects of your life.
Interesting. That's interesting. How do our choices about food limit or expand our consciousness?
Oh, wow. In so many different ways that mm-hmm. our beliefs and our associations can deeply impact our reactions to food. And I'll tell you a little story. This summer, my mom and I taught a class together. It was a Mystic Chef weekend where we had activities and group works that people could do to kind of learn to take that first step to becoming a mystic chef. And in one of the sessions, we were talking about our beliefs with food and our beliefs of certain foods and our associations with them. And one woman told this really remarkable story. She said that as a young child, she and her siblings were with a nanny, and they had witnessed a car accident. Oh. And it was very bloody. And the nanny, being a good nanny trying to protect the children, had told them that it wasn't blood, it was ketchup. But for this woman, it actually, in some ways, she was old enough to realize that it wasn't ketchup, but she was still young enough to internalize that. And for all the rest of her childhood, if she saw ketchup, she had a very violent reaction. And if it inadvertently got on her plate and was touching some of the other food, she said she would have to get up and run from the table, or she would be very, very sick. And even into her adult years, she's in her 50s or 60s now, she said she's better with ketchup. but it's still, she can't eat it, but she can at least be around it now. And it wasn't for a very long time until she realized that connection, that she had associated the trauma of witnessing that really horrific accident with ketchup. And so that's, you know, that's a very intense example, but all of us, to some extent, have strong beliefs and reactions and associations with food, whether we know it or not. And it might be as simple as you're eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, for instance, when you're a child, and your mom or your father, whoever is, you know, there with you, maybe is telling you, oh, well, the Jones family next door, they might have a lot more than we do. They've got a lot of money, but money doesn't buy happiness. And forever in your life, you associate, without even knowing it, that peanut butter and jelly sandwich with a feeling of a lack of abundance. Because in your mind, you hear money doesn't buy happiness. So for your rest of your life, without even knowing it, you stop striving to get ahead in life in a way, because you've got this deep connection in your mind between that peanut butter and jelly sandwich and your mother saying, money doesn't buy happiness. And the mom wasn't wrong in that case necessarily. It's just, you know, you can internalize things very literally, especially when you're a child. But the really fascinating, wonderful thing about food is you can reprogram yourself. So next time you eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, imagine a different scenario. Imagine somebody saying, you know, money and happiness are, you know, not mutually exclusive. You can have it all. And change it to whatever fits you, so it broadens your horizons and really does expand your consciousness in really profound ways.
Interesting. That's an interesting analogy. I like that. And, you know, speaking of that, many people believe that growth comes from suffering. But in the Mystic Cookbook, you say that spiritual breakthroughs can come simply by the way you eat. And you just describe that, how it's all, what's other possible ways?
Yeah, isn't that great? You don't have to suffer to grow.
No, I mean, exactly. Joy through pain, or, you know, whatever. You can learn through joy.
Right, exactly. And for those who have suffered, finding, you know, like that phoenix rising out of the ashes, there can be amazing leaps and bounds that can come from suffering. If you are in a terrible, challenging, tragic situation, you can rise above it and life can get that much better. But you don't have to. And that I think is important to understand. My mom lived in a Zen Buddhist monastery for 2.5 years where you sit Seishen, which is sitting in the half lotus or full lotus position, for up to 16 hours a day, staring at a wall, trying not to think about anything, because that's Zen meditation. And the monks will come and hit you with a stick if they think that you're thinking. And my mom said during that time, it was a peaceful time in her life, especially after all of the struggles and challenges of her childhood, but she did not get enlightened. So it's a good example of, it doesn't necessarily, doing things that seem spiritually minded, seem challenging, or you have to work through, they can be enlightening, they can be relaxing and peaceful, but it doesn't have to be the only way. And a wonderful way is to grow and have breakthroughs by enjoying life. You know, the more beauty you find in the world, the more beauty you have in your life. You know, it's a wonderful way of thinking. The more joy you experience, the more joyful your life is. And food is such a great way to do that. One, because we all have to do it all the time. Mm-hmm. So why not make it into the thing in your life that really is that anchor that creates these metaphors for how you want to go out in the world? And have fun with it. And, I mean, you can tell I'm passionate about food, and I know that not everybody is, but there are a lot of things. We offer tips and suggestions in the book for ways that you can be a mystic chef without ever even turning on the oven.
And that's great, yeah, because Because, you know, I have to cook for my fiance too, and it's like I read the book and I said, wow, so, you know, cooking together, you know, you can find joy in that. There's different ways of doing things. Life doesn't have to be just about doing it one way. And in the Mystic Cookbook, you use the phrase, from nourishment to nirvana. What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, it very much stems off of what we were saying, that we have this idea, especially in this country, in the U.S., we have this idea that food is fuel. It's sustenance. It's what keeps us going, but it's nothing more. Many of us have a relationship with food that is broken down into calories, carbs, sugars, fats, proteins. We don't necessarily see the whole. They did a study at the University of Pennsylvania in the psychology department, and they asked a group of French women to give a one-word description of chocolate cake. Most of the French women said celebration. And the American women, the same picture, most of them said guilt. And so you can see the difference in the way that we approach food here. If we eat a carrot, sometimes it's not about the carrot itself. We're eating the carrot because it's got beta carotene. It's good for our eyes. It's really everything here. And I'm making generalizations, of course, but it's reduced down to its nutritive qualities rather than the greater picture. So when we step beyond that and start to see our nourishment not just as a way of intaking calories so that we can fuel our bodies, so that we can move on to the next task, but when we start to look at the way that we eat as a spiritual experience, as something that's joyful and pleasurable, and I'm not talking about hedonism here, I'm talking about ways that it really can be a mindful experience, you really can step into that state of nirvana. And in the book, we explain more clearly and give more suggestions, but that's a little, what's the appetizer, if you will, to use a food metaphor.
And how about the color of our food, our plates, our dining room affect our consciousness? I mean, you have some good analogies, but can you give us one? How can the coloring and the plates and, can you give some examples?
Yeah, there's so much I could say about color, and I always have to try to rein myself in because I could go on forever. But color affects us so deeply in so many ways. For instance, in psychiatric hospitals, they've realized that if they paint the walls pink, the I don't want to say inmates, but the patients will calm down. Pink has a very calming effect on the inmates there. They've also noticed that if you want to feel more joyful, yellow and orange are really kind of creative, joyful colors. And so if you want to have that in your kitchen, that's a wonderful color to paint, or in your dining room if you want to feel kind of this like childlike exuberance. You might also notice that fast food restaurants and chain stores often use a lot of red. What color is predominantly at McDonald's or, say, Target? It's red because it's an appetite stimulant. It gets your appetite going, makes you want more, more, more. But then green, it's a very calming. It aids in digestion. In Morocco, they serve mint tea at the end of the meal, primarily because mint is aids in digestion, but also the green color affects us in a deep way that way. And what I find really fascinating, too, is color. It affects our perception much more than we're even aware. They did a study where they gave a group of people a glass of orange juice and had them rate its sweetness, and then they gave them the same orange juice but dyed it brighter. And everybody said that the brighter colored orange juice tasted sweeter, even though it was the very same orange juice. And then they gave them the original one, not dyed, with more sugar. And they still said that the darker colored orange juice tasted sweeter than the one that was actually sweeter with the added sugar. So I think it's so fascinating how color affects us on so many levels, and it does affect our perception. So, of course, color is important to eat because we get all the different micronutrients that each color represents within our different fruits and vegetables. But beyond that, it affects our perception and and our experience of what we're eating in really deep ways, and even makes us eat more or less. So it's pretty powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yes, it is. And how can food be used to trigger past life memories? It's funny you're talking about the Moroccan mint tea, because my mom used to grow mint in the backyard, and as a kid, I would like that after my meal. So I just think I had a past life memory trigger here.
Oh, maybe you did. That would be so awesome. As far as food in past lives, in the book, we talk about two different ways that past lives and food are connected. One way is you can be eating a food and it can automatically trigger a memory. Just as you were saying with the mint, it might be now if you're eating mint, suddenly it could trigger a memory. Especially if you're eating a food that you haven't had a lot of. We give an example in the book of a woman who, as a child, for the first time, had had some American Chinese food. She lived in the small town in the Midwest, I think it was the Midwest, somewhere where it wasn't very common to have Chinese food. And it was eye-opening for her. Even as a young child, she couldn't get enough of it. She begged her parents for more, more, more. Anytime they went out to eat, she wanted to go out for Chinese food. And in her adult years, she finally tasted, I can't remember, it was authentic Vietnamese or Thai food, and had this past life memory kind of triggered, and it was a very happy experience, a wonderful life for her, and the food really triggered it for her. And she realized that as a child, that kind of Americanized fried Chinese with the yellow, bright yellow and pink sauces was kind of a stand-in for this authentic Thai or Vietnamese, I can't remember what it was, cuisine that triggered this past life memory. So that is one way. It can kind of happen naturally when you have something and it's like, oh my God, this is the way that food is supposed to taste, or this is the way that you're supposed to eat. You can have those thoughts that often can be an indicator of a possible past life. But alternatively, you can do the reverse. Mm-hmm. If you've done a past life regression and you've discovered that you had a past life in a certain time period or region, then you can create a past life meal, and we give directions in the Mystic Cookbook for doing this, where you maybe dress in traditional clothing and play music from that time period and create the foods that people would have eaten in that time, and it can take you that much deeper, and especially if you have some issues you want to work through, it can be a really wonderful way to work through those issues. Maybe you had a past life in a time period or a region where you didn't have enough food. So now recreate it where you feel abundant and you have lots to eat. But in that time period, and by working through the past, it can actually have lasting effects in the present. And it doesn't even have to be a past life around food, but food, because it's something, it's a common thread throughout all of history. It's a wonderful medium for accessing those memories.
Wow. Yeah, you even talk about, some people have hearty breakfasts, so they have a long day ahead, or do they eat later? There's so many different facets in this book that it's not your typical cookbook at all. It really isn't.
No.
I loved it. I was like, wow, this is great. Why is it so important to have good feng shui in your kitchen and dining space? Why is that so important that people practice that?
And feng shui is really more my mom's area of expertise, but I can jump in and add my two cents. but really, from dating back to antiquity, the kitchen is really, it's the heart of the home. Mm-hmm. Now we have the stove, but in the days of yore, it was the hearth, the fire. It's where everybody gathered. It was the central point in the home. It was the place where families gathered, stories were told, people recounted the events of their day. And even now, especially, American kitchens, they're open floor plan, and children will do their homework on the table while the mom or dad is cooking the meal. And it's that central place in the home. So it's very important on many levels. And when you have good feng shui, and your space is clean and clutter cleared, it allows for more of that chi, more of that energy to flow through. And I notice in my own life, there's there's that idea that really does it make a difference if you have, you know, what, you know, they say you shouldn't have cold next to the stove. So I have my refrigerator next to the stove. So they say you should put a wooden spoon there to ignite that fire so the cold doesn't put out the fire of the stove. And some, you know, there's always that part in my mind that's like, really? That seems kind of superstitious. Does it work? But then there's that other part that's like, it doesn't matter if you think it works, because if it does, why not go with it? But I've noticed for me, I have a very, very, very tiny kitchen. It's almost impossible not to have dirty dishes stacked up. You know, I've got about, you know, a 2-foot square countertop space, which is pretty remarkable that I was able to test and retest all the recipes in the book in my tiny kitchen.
Yeah, really?
But, yeah. But I've noticed, so it's, you know, it's easy. If I'm not constantly doing dishes, there's a buildup because there's nowhere to put anything. But I noticed that when I take that time just to simply wash the dishes and straighten the kitchen, maybe sweep the floor, suddenly everything in my life feels better. And I know that seems crazy, but I've had days where I'm feeling so overwhelmed. I can't possibly continue. Everybody needs something from me yesterday, and I'm way behind, and I can't continue, you know. And it's like everything starts to spiral out of control, you know, and then it spirals more, and nobody loves me. I'll never find love. You know, it just keeps on going. It gets worse and worse. And the most amazing thing is, though, almost always when I take that time to clean my kitchen, organize it, put stuff away, make it sparkling and shiny, suddenly every aspect of my life starts to feel better. And the things that seemed so overwhelming before suddenly don't seem so bad, or that suddenly I'm able to do them without so much effort. And so it may, you know, some ways it seems a little extreme or it seems superstitious, but it really does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. And in the Mystic Cookbook, there's a chapter entitled Legendary Meals. What makes a meal legendary, and why might someone want to embark on such a dinner odyssey?
Well, legendary meal, it's kind of the culmination of the book. In the Mystic Cookbook, we start at the beginning talking about the book being a mystic chef apprenticeship, where if you do the activities and some of the suggestions and you follow the ideas and the different, I'm getting all tongue-tied, but you do the activities in the book, kind of at the end you end up at this idea of a legendary meal. And a legendary meal, it's the type of meal that people will remember for a lifetime. Because it's not just about the food. It's not just about eating. It's a much deeper experience. It is, in a sense, it is an experience. It heightens all of the senses and takes you to other time periods, to other places in the world, to experience on a much, much deeper level. And as I was saying, taking the inner journeys, that's a wonderful component of a legendary meal because, as I said, I was using the example of the Salade Niçoise and being on the south of France and seeing the Côte d'Azur and the beautiful beach and the hot waiter. You know, that's the start to a legendary meal. It's where you're taking it to the next level. But they don't have to be very involved or complicated. We have examples and suggestions in the Mystic Cookbook for legendary meals that can be as simple as recreating the Goldilocks and the Three Bears story with your children and have them eat the porridge and say, it's too hot, it's too cold. Or it can be a big affair that takes you days to plan and you get into every detail. So they really can be as elaborate or simple as you want, but they are this deep inner experience as well as an outer experience, and they are so much fun.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. With Valentine's Day coming upon us, there's legends about certain foods being aphrodisiacs. However, you have a different take on this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I do, and As far as aphrodisiacs, I think they work in a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. One is there are, you know, I'm not a scientist, but from my understanding of aphrodisiacs, there are components in certain foods that can ignite vigor and passion and sexuality and sensuality. But in most cases, you would have to eat them in very, very large quantities to really get that full benefit. For instance, a great example is cayenne pepper. The capsaicin in hot chilies is considered an aphrodisiac. But can you imagine how many chilies you'd have to eat to get enough to really, like, ignite that passion?
Wow.
I mean, you'd probably be spitting flames beforehand. But the power lays not just in the fact that it has the capsaicin, but in the collective belief. If there are a lot of people that all believe in the aphrodisiacal, I'm not even sure if that's a word. Someday I will learn if that's a word so I can keep saying it. But if a number of people all believe in those properties, it actually starts to create this collective belief that can heighten the experience. But the main ingredient in creating any sort of aphrodisiac is your intention and your belief. We talked before about associations and beliefs that people have with food, as with the example of the woman with ketchup and the other example of the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's the same thing with aphrodisiacs. When you eat something that with the intent that it will ignite passion, love, joy, sensuality, sexual, all of those kind of feelings that we want to heighten, especially around Valentine's Day, it can actually make a difference. And I have a YouTube video, actually, with a recipe for what I call a mystic elixir for love. It's hot chocolate recipe. And, I mean, isn't that just fun to say?
Yeah.
Mystic elixir for love.
I love it.
But it's a hot chocolate recipe, and I use cocoa, which Montezuma, they say, drank 50 glasses of cocoa a day to increase his vigor and virility. And we sweeten it with honey, which is considered kind of a sacred substance throughout most of the world and throughout history, especially because bees were considered the intermediaries between heaven and earth because they could fly. And then you add little sprinkles of cayenne, which has that red color, which we were talking about color before, which is also connected to our base chakra, our root chakra. It's that red is that color of passion and vitality. And it's got that capsaicin we were talking about, too. And you sprinkle that cayenne in with that intention of bringing love and passion in all its permutations. It can be love for another, love for self, just opening your heart wider. And then you blend it together and make this cocoa, which is delicious. Plus, it's really fun to get into that idea of creating this mystic elixir for love.
I love that. That's great. Now, I'll find a little more of a tangent. You say in the Mystic Cookbook that reading the book and doing the suggested activities is a mystic chef apprenticeship. What does it mean to be a mystic chef, and how is that different than being another kind of chef or cook?
Well, being a mystic chef, as I said, it's not just about knife skills and knowing the difference between braising and sautéing, for instance. It's a much more spiritual experience. Being a mystic chef, you don't actually, as I said, have to cook, which for me, that's like the horror of horrors. Why wouldn't you cook? Because I'm so passionate about that. But I do understand that lots of people don't have that passion. They have other passions. But you can be a mystic chef by the way that you approach your food. And it can be a number of different things. And we list more of them in the Mystic Cookbook, but it can be as simple as saying grace before your meal. It can also be recognizing the people who planted the food that you're eating, the people who grew it, the people who tended to it, the people who took it to market, those who stocked the shelves at your grocery store, those who prepared it. And noticing that whole journey that your food has taken is another step that you can do. Another way is simply by having this deeper connection with your food. The next time you eat cauliflower, for instance, I mean, cauliflower is kind of boring, right? But if you really spend time looking at that beautiful, beautiful head of cauliflower, it actually changes your perception of not just the way it looks, but actually the way that you will taste it the next time when you see how stunning it is and how amazing nature is to create these beautiful foods for us. So being a mystic chef is not just about cooking with love and intention and using that in your cooking. It's also about the way that you eat your meals and the way that you shop for them. And we all have to eat. So there, everybody can become a mystic chef if they so desire by following the steps in the book. And eventually we were going to be even doing some mystic chef certification courses, but they are still just in the works at this moment.
Interesting. And I'm going to skip down a little bit. What advice would you give to someone who says they're too busy to eat well, or that good food is too expensive?
Yeah, I get that a lot. And I think a lot of it is a mindset, as with anything. Any of us who get really stressed, and I was really stressed a couple of days, I can't get it all done. And my mom stopped me, said, take a breath. She says, it's a mindset. Mm-hmm. You have the time. You just have to change your mindset about it. And it's very similar with food, too. People say, I'm too busy. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, it doesn't take any more time. When I was teaching, I was a school teacher for a number of years, I did start to understand why people liked convenience foods, because it seems faster. But often, by the time, I don't have a microwave, so that does add time, but I'd get like a frozen quiche at Trader Joe's. It takes an hour in the oven to make that quiche, the teeny tiny quiche.
Hmm.
Making pasta for yourself or a salad takes maybe 15, 20 minutes. It doesn't actually take as long as we think. And but the benefits will far outweigh that extra 5-10 minutes it might take to put that time into creating the meal, and then to sit down and eat it mindfully. And as far as cost, it depends, of course, for everybody where they're located. I live on the coast of California, so we are blessed to have really good produce available year-round. And it is harder for people in other parts of the country. But I suggest that it's always about a balance. Splurge in certain areas and then cut back in others. There are ways, too, and I've learned this in my years of catering. There are ways you can make certain meals stretch really far. One of my favorites is carrot soup. A whole big old bag of carrots costs nothing. But you can have this wonderful meal with a good bread and some carrot soup. And then maybe your next meal you splurge on something that's expensive or different or tastier. It doesn't have to be expensive, but it's always, I'm a Libra too. I like the balance. But there are a lot of different, tips and tricks that you can do that doesn't necessarily make quality food any more expensive. And I definitely urge people to take that time to slow down, eat mindfully, and you don't have to cook for yourself, but when you do, your love infuses into it, and then you're eating that back. So it's gets you twofold.
What is the route to optimum health? I could talk to the happiness and well-being. What is the route to that?
Can you say that again?
Oh, I'm sorry. My optimum health, happiness, and well-being. What's the root to those things?
I think it's different for every person. I don't believe there's any one diet that works for everybody. And I do think that when we get too caught up in any one particular diet or way of eating, it actually becomes limiting. And it limits our own parameters, and it limits, when we get too caught up in it, it also limits our way we perceive the world and others. But I do believe the biggest way to optimum health is really to eat what you love and love what you eat and do so joyfully and savor those foods. If you eat chocolate cake, you know, maybe don't eat it every single day for every meal, but when you eat it, cherish every bite, savor it, enjoy it. It's that guilt we were talking about earlier that came up in the study at the University of Pennsylvania that in a lot of ways is more detrimental than whatever less than healthy things that are in that chocolate cake. So I really say enjoy your food, savor it, and eat slowly, eat mindfully, and that really is, that puts you on the route to optimum health because food is, it's about the nutrition that we get from it, but it's also about our emotions and our feelings when we eat it because when we eat stressed, our cortisol levels are high and we actually start eating more stress. And the more we get stressed, the more we eat and our cortisol levels raise and raise and raise. So the more you are calm and relaxed and really grateful and delighted to be eating whatever you're eating, it actually is a lot healthier.
That is very true. That's very true. In the Mystic Cookbook, you also write about inviting a cooking angel into your kitchen. Does this really work? I can say yes.
You know, it does. And there is still that skeptical part of me that thinks, this is way out there. How can that be? But I know that it works. And this is why. For a number of years, as you know, I've been catering my mom's retreats. And people sometimes would say, how do you do it? Because I often cook by myself. There's up to 25 people at a retreat. I do 3 meals a day, 2 snacks, multi-courses, usually 3 to 5 courses in every meal. And I work out of a pretty small kitchen. And people say, how do you do it? And sometimes I don't know how I do it. And so I started to kind of joke that I had a kitchen angel. And I said it almost tongue-in-cheek, like partially believing it, but partially thinking, yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I had an experience not too long ago where I was cooking for one of these retreats, and I was making a Vietnamese meal. I think it was Vietnamese Thai. I think I was kind of doing a little cross-cultural meal there. And I had maybe an hour, maybe 30 minutes left until it was time to serve. I had planned 5 courses, and I still had to peel the winter squash for a curry I was making. And if you've ever tried peeling winter squash, especially for 25 people, that in itself could take you an hour. Uh-huh. And I hadn't even started another stir fry I was making. The rice was still soaking. I hadn't even washed the lettuce for the salad. So you can see where I'm going with this. I was starting to panic, and it was probably 100 degrees outside. And I thought, okay, I've been talking about this kitchen angel for a long time. I'm going to put him to work. And so in that moment, I took maybe 30 seconds, and I took a deep breath, and I said, dear kitchen angel, please come help me. I really need you now. I would be so very grateful. And this is what the remarkable thing was. The clock stopped moving. Mm. And I managed to peel all of that winter squash, chop it, get it in the curry, get the curry simmering, make the sautéed vegetables, get the rice cooking, make the salad. And when there were about 30 minutes left, the clock started moving again. Mm. And then a little while later, maybe about 10, 15 minutes before it was time to serve, and I always pride myself on being on time, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 of the women who were in the training class came into the kitchen and said, okay, we're here, we're ready to help. And I felt as though my kitchen angel had given me divine help by stopping the clock, but then he sent in these terrestrial angels, if you will, these women who came in, and they really helped with that final stage. I still needed to grate the carrots, and slice the peppers for the salad and make a salad dressing, and the curry was still simmering. The squash needed to be cooked fully. Mm-hmm. And they got us to that point where it was all done on time. Wow. I was able to take a deep breath and relax and get the meal out, and it was a magnificent meal. And I really do believe that my kitchen angel came to my rescue. So in the book, we talk about, we have a meditation that people can do to invite the kitchen angel into their life. I cook all the time. I don't ask him to join me every time I cook. But I feel as though he's there guiding and watching me, even without consciously calling him forward. But it can be, I don't know, it was eye-opening for me.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Yes, that's true. That's true. I'm going to skip down a little bit because our time is running short here. In the final chapter, you give a brief guide for grocery shopping, which I absolutely hate, and I get my fiancé to do it. Why is it important to understand some of the
issues? I love grocery shopping.
Not me, I know. I think I'd rather cook than grocery shop. Why is it important to understand some of the issues we face each time we shop?
Well, as you said, the final chapter of the book is, it's kind of a quick reference, if you will, for a number of the issues that we're faced at the grocery store these days. And we don't go into great depth in any of the different issues because it's not really part of, it's not the full scope of the book. But it is important when we go to the grocery store to be aware. And there are so many questions we face these days. It's not just, do I buy tomatoes or do I buy cucumbers? We're faced now with, do I buy organic? Do I buy locally grown? GMO, GMO-free, gluten-free? There are so many different questions. So we do go into some of the different options at the store. And I believe strongly in getting the highest quality produce possible, ones, if you can, that were grown with love and care, using high quality. I like to use heirloom seeds in my own garden. But I also know that it's not possible for everybody, depending on where you live and what's available. But we do offer in the end of the book just a kind of an overview of what these options are and these choices. And really what it comes down to is get the best quality that you can according to your beliefs. And then even when you can't, as we were talking about before, it's the more you can remove judgment from your food choices, I think the healthier you will be. So sometimes, you know, sometimes it's that brightly colored red package that jumps out at you. Sometimes you just have to get it and eat it, even if it goes against everything you believe. But when possible, and this is what the last chapter of the book about is about really, is, you know, finding local, organic, GMO-free, or if you go to the farmer's market, I always find myself being drawn to the people with the most kind of vitality, energy, friendliness. They might not even have the best products, but I buy from them over and over again because they just have such this great energy. And I don't know, it's hard because I love grocery shopping. That's probably why I do it way more than I need to. But it is important to be aware of all of the issues when you're shopping. But it's also important sometimes to let that go, too. Otherwise, if we're constantly in our mind, can I get this, can I get this, is this okay, is this okay? Mm-hmm. It's exhausting. And that also is not healthy.
No, it's not. And I try to grow my own produce as much as I can, but I'm in New York State here, so I have to go where I have to go. So I'd rather just, you know, grow my own stuff. It's just I put the love and the intention in the ground just for me, but... where can someone get a copy of the Mystic Cookbook? I think it's a great book. I would recommend it, definitely.
Oh, thank you so much, Amy. The Mystic Cookbook is available on Amazon and from Hay House, the publisher, hayhouse.com, and from your local book retailer, too, I hope. And we also have a website that has links to places to buy it, and our website is called themysticcookbook.com, so it's pretty easy to remember.
And any final thoughts before we sign off here, Meadow?
Oh, goodness. I guess I will repeat my little mantra, eat what you love and love what you eat. And it's been such a joy being on your show, Amy.
Oh, thank you so much, Meadow, for coming on today. And great book. I hope you do another book with your mom. You guys seem to collaborate quite well.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Meadow, and thank you, everyone, for listening. May everyone have a blessed day. Take care. Bye-bye.